I have with me here today the questions on Sullivan, that is, the coronation of Charlemagne. I understand that these have come in at the bookstore now. Yes. And I thought I would get the questions out to you today so that those of you who will perhaps want to work on them over the holidays will have that opportunity. I'll pass them out along in here. There will be extra copies before they get to the rear. Over that way, please. Please, do, I'd like to have the extra copies back. Pardon? No, I gave you the page 3 in class yesterday. This will be due 4 or 5 periods after the holidays, somewhere in the second week after we return. You mean the coronation of Charlemagne? The coronation of Charlemagne will not be on the exam. This reading will not be on the exam. These questions are to take care of that. So your examination is these questions on this reading. Yes, sir? No, there are others. Yes, that's in the, for the next, for the second unit. For the second part, yes, for the second unit. This is for the first unit. Mean for the second unit? Would you see me privately on that? Fine. Today I'd like to take up with you the synthesis, if you will, or the tradition of learning, classical and Christian, in the early Middle Ages from the years 400 through 800. We had a few remarks remaining from yesterday's outline. We will make those in the discussion period. We have to keep moving. I'd like to begin this today. We will not be able to complete it. We will complete it then the first period after we return from the holidays. The question of learning in the early Middle Ages, it seems to me at least, is one of the most important, one of the most interesting of all of the topics we discuss, since it demonstrates how the traditions of classical learning, Latin learning, were transmitted northward from the Mediterranean to this new civilization period in Western civilization that is associated with continental Europe rather than with the Mediterranean area. There are a number of excellent books here that I would like to mention again if I have already mentioned them, because I hope that some of you will take the hint and perhaps take a few of them home. I think that they are interesting reading. Eleanor Duckett, D-U-C-K-E-T-T, who is in your bibliography, has written a good many works on this period. This is her field of study. And she is a scholarly, and yet she's a scholar who writes in a popular style, which makes her very interesting. No footnotes. The material that she does is so obviously from the sources that footnotes are, except in rare instances, altogether unnecessary. Her Gateway to the Middle Ages is just a tremendous book that at this level you ought to be able to read as a bedtime story. It's that kind of literature. Just as interesting, too. That was published in 38. There is an earlier edition of it from 1930 called Latin Writers of the Fifth Century that you might be able to might find. It's in our library. I know that both of them are. You might not find one, but you can take the other. Then another one is by E. Rand, R-A-N-D, Founders of the Middle Ages. I read both of these books as an undergraduate, and it was a fascinating experience. They are very similar in nature. Rand is a little bit more technical than Duckett, but all in all, they're very fine. Another man who has written a number of books in this area and whose field this is Leisner, L-A-I-S-T-N-E-R, who taught for many years at Cornell. His intellectual heritage of the early Middle Ages is not as popularly written as Duckett and Rand's books are, but it is far more thorough and gives you a very, very deep insight into the mind of the early Middle Ages. And then the books by Henry Osborne Taylor that have probably been mentioned to you already, T-A-Y-L-O-R. The one in paperback that we have in the syllabus, The Emergence of Christian Culture in the West, I believe it has a new title now in paperback. I'm not altogether confident about what that is. But in any case, it deals with the intellectual, the mind of the early Middle Ages and how it comes out of the classical mind. And then his two-volume study published by Harvard, The Medieval Mind. This is one of those books like Charles Norris Cochran's Christianity and Classical Culture that every liberal arts student ought to have read already. If you have not as yet read The Medieval Mind, this is a book that is just simply part of the literature of the humanities. And it's wonderfully written, very fascinatingly done. All of these books are. John Herman Randall's The Making of the Modern Mind. Here I would suggest that you start at the very beginning and read what he has to say also about the ancient mind, and then what he has to add about that in this period of synthesis. The Making of the Modern Mind by John Herman Randall. He wrote that when he was a freshman with his PhD, right away from his PhD. He wrote it when he was very young. He hasn't written anything comparable since. This is a masterpiece. And again, one that seriously consider for holiday reading. Then another work that I would, and this, these are top, this is a topic now, the Bible in the Middle Ages. It's a topic with which we are usually concerned. There are two books. There are more than two books on this in the library, by the way. But there are two that I would like to recommend to you as very interesting. McNally, M-C, capital N-A-L-L-Y, The Bible in the Early Middle Ages. How it was used, how it was interpreted. I think it's all very important. And then another book, The Study of the Bible in the Middle Ages, by Smalley, S-M-A-L-L-Y. Smalley, The Study of the Bible in the Middle Ages. This is much more lengthy, but it goes into a great detail in the matter of the exegetical, the development of the medieval exegetical tradition and the popularity, the use of Bibles in the early Middle Ages. There are other books in your bibliographies. These I would like to recommend especially because they are holiday reading. I'm very quite serious about that. They're the kind of books that I think you will enjoy, not only because you're preparing for an examination, but because you will enjoy them on their own merit. They are well done. If you're interested primarily in philosophy, I don't think I need to mention to you the works by Gilson, and Ten Gilson. There are a number of them. Look up his name, G-I-L-S-O-N, in the library and on the Middle Ages. And then there is a very nice book on late medieval philosophy by Gordon Leff, L-E-F-F, that's in paperback. And I think you'll find that interesting reading. Well, beyond and above that, look at the bibliography. The first question that I would like to take up in connection with this, then, is the whole question of the Dark Age, or Dark Ages. I don't use terms like this, because I don't agree with them in the first place, and I'm not so sure that it's good historiography in the second place anyway. We have become so accustomed to talking about the Italian Renaissance since Burckhardt. And since Burckhardt, Renaissances have proliferated through various centuries in the ancient world, and then especially the various medieval Renaissances, as they are called. And then, of course, we're now beginning to talk also, those who still use this kind of terminology, about the Renaissance in the 18th century. So that the history is being filled with Renaissances, which isn't, it seems to me, the kind of thing that we want to talk about. The same way with terms like revival and declines, revivals and declines, or descents. Laharet is very, he loves to use terms like this. This is an age of revival. Here there was a glimmer of light. As we read these generalizations, we always ask the question, what are you referring to specifically? When you talk about this being an age of decline, what makes it an age of decline? And usually when you spell it out, then you have to admit that there are other areas that you are not talking about that are not included because they are not in a decline. The early Middle Ages is the great period for the synthesis of classical culture with Christianity. More than this, it is one of the greatest of all ages for Christian missions. This is not a period, then, that we can call a period of decline. Certainly, it was a period when political structures were often in chaos. Certainly, it is a period when the economy of Europe was shifting from a trade economy on the Mediterranean to a land economy on the continent of Europe. All of this is very important. I would prefer to describe these as shifts, however, from the Mediterranean to Europe than as declines and revivals and renaissances and descents and glimmers of light and all this kind of thing, which doesn't make a great deal of sense to me. And this is why I've always been very much interested in this period. I don't think that you can call it, really, a dark age. There are areas in it where you would certainly have to say things look dark. But to speak of it as a dark age ignores some of the most important things, that took place during this period. About 4 years ago, I heard Professor Sullivan from the University of Michigan, who is the author of this little book that I recommended to you on heirs of the Roman Empire, on this question. And he mentioned a lot of things that I had never even considered for this period, which should lead us to question the title Dark Ages in the area of technology, which is something, of course, most of us don't give too much thought to. He relies here heavily on the theses of Dopsch, whom those of you who are familiar with this period will know is associated with Henri Pirin. And the study of economic history. That book, by the way, is in the bookstore, Pirin's History of Europe. And it's a wonderful study of Europe from the economic point of view. Pirin obviously taking much of his propulsion from the Marxist analysis of economic factors in history. but such things as the single family farm, which most of us wouldn't bother to look at. And yet that develops in this period, according to Sullivan. The heavy plow develops in this period. And something even more important, the harness, so that you can use horses in the field, which hadn't been done prior to this period. The horseshoe, another one of these technological advances that we take so for granted. Another one that he mentioned, I have no way of either disputing this or affirming it, is that the crank was invented during this period, or at least came into common use. These are the items that we take a passing glance at them because they are not so important for church history. But certainly, when I speak in B here of the development of institutions, you have the development of the two great institutions that we have just discussed, the papacy and monasticism, which are both products of this early medieval period, must be called institutional developments, which make it something other than what we would normally call a dark age. Not only the papacy, but the role of the bishop as a governing bishop. The development of the diocesan bishop in the church, and that this individual also has civil authority. This is something that, as we've already indicated, isn't typical of the early church, but develops in this period. Certainly it develops to meet the needs of the time. We won't quarrel with that. Just as that is true of the heavy plow, just as that is true of the three-field system. Now that depends on climate, depends on the situation. So this does too. But it is a new kind of institution in Western Europe that comes out of this period. The governing bishop, the bishop that is also the civil official, you see. And then I don't think we need to say any more about the rule, the institution of monasticism itself. But then, perhaps most important of all, the development of intellectual life on a new basis. The absorption of especially the Latin classics into the educational traditions that ultimately flower. There again, we're using one of those terms, you see, during the time of Charlemagne. By flowering there, I would mean primarily that we have more examples during the time of Charlemagne of learning in this area than we have previously, names and books and things of that sort. Puren, in his book, attempts to assert that the Carolingian period, 800, the period toward which we are moving now, you see, is really merely the residue of classical culture and no more. I don't believe that this is true, and I think any of these books that I have recommended to you here will demonstrate that for you. I would agree much more here, I think, with Dawson, who looks upon the intellectual life of this period as a gathering together of scattered elements of the classical and patristic tradition and their reorganization. And that's the point, not only the gathering together, the transmission, but their reorganization as the basis of a new European culture. And that is the greatest achievement in the area of the intellect during this period. So much of it is related to education. No longer is education in Europe directed toward the same objectives that classical education was directed. If you're judging all of civilization by the standards of classical civilization, obviously you have a decline here, because you have a new tradition of education developing, a tradition that is concerned primarily with the elucidation of Christian doctrine, of the Holy Scripture, and its application for human life, the common life, a transmission of religious knowledge as distinct, not separate from, hardly separate from, but as distinct from the emphasis in classical education on rhetoric, on the ability to speak, that kind of thing, or even on the question of even the emphasis in Neoplatonism on the nature of reality. You see, this is no longer the aim of education in the early Middle Ages. Well, we could go, we'll be saying far more about that as we, much more about that as we proceed now into this section of this unit. I want, first of all, to talk about the early Christian use of classical education, including the material that we will be reading, in Jerome's letters.
That better? I think that's a little bit more sharp, isn't it?
The early Christian use of classical education, and then section 3, which isn't on there, is the transmission and assimilation giving you a great many of the names and the books and things of that sort. The important section here, however, is this second one on the use. I suppose the most important thing that can be said here, and the simplest thing of all, is that the church preserved the classics. That's enough. You see, they were preserved in the church during this period. But I think there are other problems that we should take up in this whole area of the Christian use of classical education. First of all, people that came to the Christian church to be catechized, some of them to go further and to become the great theologians in the church, certainly up until the 5th century, were men who were trained either in grammar school, or usually, if they became the great theologians, had gone on to some school of rhetoric in the classical tradition. Now, in other words, what I am saying is that there were the individuals who became Christians and who went on to become the great teachers in the church were individuals who were classically trained. Well, that's the first point. The church couldn't avoid that. The only education that was available, aside from a school like Origins in Alexandria, but generally speaking, in the whole Roman Empire, the education that was available was a classical education. This meant that you learned how to write and speak, grammar and rhetoric. And this, of course, involved in these two things is the study of history, the study of mythology, the study of philosophy. All of that is associated in one way or another with the trivium and the quadrivium as we know them. With the objective, first of all, of moral training. Some of the best discussions we have of this, of course, come from the reign of Julian in the 360s, who attempts to point out the objectives of classical education and making it impossible for a Christian to teach in the classical schools, as we've already learned. But mainly, as you know, classical education directed the student of rhetoric into civil service. So is the function, the larger function of the classical tradition. Well, now, the individuals who came to the church came with these, with more or less of this training. That this is true is very obvious from the materials that we have from the 4th century fathers, the 5th century fathers, on the training of a convert. How do you catechize a convert? What can you assume? And there they indicate Cyril, for example, Cyril of Jerusalem in his catechetical lectures from the late fourth century, or in Augustine's on catechizing the uninstructed. You have these references to the problems involved. Cyril says, since all cannot read the scriptures, some being hindered as to the knowledge of them by want of learning, and others by want of leisure, in order that the soul may not perish from ignorance, we comprise the whole doctrine of the faith in a few lines. And this is the way he introduces the symbol, the Catholic Creed. Or again, in the same lectures, let those here present whose habit of mind is mature and who have, quote, their senses already exercised to discern good and evil, quoting Hebrews 5, let those endure patiently to listen to things fitted rather for children and to an introductory course, as it were, of milk, that at the same time both those who have need of the instruction may be benefited and those who have the knowledge may rekindle the remembrance of things, and so on and so forth. Augustine, in his catechizing the uninstructed, becomes even more explicit, and he even divides his classes between those who had the benefit of a classical training in the grammatical schools and the rhetorical schools from those who did not. This is in parentheses now. This is the next course I hope to get developed here. By the time you return as seniors, I hope this will be an offering as a free elective and also for graduate study. The early Christian efforts at catechizing, just how they went about this. The evidence, we have a great deal of evidence in this area from many fathers, Cyril, Augustine, Chrysostom, Nyssa, and so forth. Even fathers as early as Cyprian and Tertullian give us some hints here about what they did. I mention this here because if any of you are interested in doing an extra kind of project, I would appreciate very much getting help in some of the preliminary studies that must go into constructing a course of this kind. Since we're so, all of us are so interested, will be, if we're not already, interested in catechetics, and especially the teachers who study here, who catechize every day in the classroom, I think this would make a very interesting kind of historical study. And one of the basic things I'd like to get out of the way, first of all, is to compare some of these treatments on various doctrines. To take the doctrine of creation, say, or the atonement, and compare how this is treated, how the individual is catechized in this area from one father to another. This should have some relevance for your New Testament studies, if you're interested primarily there, and so forth, certainly in the area of dogmatics. So if somebody's interested in doing something like that, please don't hesitate to make that known to me. I appreciate any efforts that you can put out for me there. I'll direct you into the proper readings and so forth. Now, that's the first item, then, that the people who came to the church were educated in the classical tradition. Now, the second thing that I think we have to note here is the item of fear that I have under B. Christians, by and large, feared at least in part, the classical tradition. They feared it, first of all, because of its obvious errors. It was at times polytheistic. It was at times a believer in the teachers, that is, believed in a universe that had no direction to it at all. It was governed by chance. But mainly because the classical tradition then as now tends to make the mind critical. It develops an intellectual independence in the student, and sometimes leads to an unrestrained, sometimes an ironic kind of criticism. And many of the early fathers recoil here, and we have good examples of this in Clement and in Tertullian. So there is definitely a fear of the classical wisdom. I quote from the Didascalia, one of these books of canons from the Greek Church in the 4th and 5th centuries. Which mentions this, the student should avoid all books of the heathen. For what hast thou to do with strange sayings or laws or lying prophecies, which also turn away from the faith them that are young? What is lacking to thee in the word of God, that thou shouldst cast thyself upon these fables? If thou wouldst read classical narratives, historical narratives, turn to the Book of Kings. If philosophy, the wise men of the Old Testament, thou hast the prophets, wherein thou shalt find wisdom and understanding more than that of the wise men and philosophers. If you wish for song, you have the Psalms of David. If you would read of the beginning of the world, read Genesis by the great Moses. And if laws and commandments, you have the Torah. All strange writings, therefore, which are contrary to these, eschew altogether. Don't read them. They will only mislead you. You have councils in the 4th and 5th centuries, which actually forbid the Christian and the Christian cleric from becoming part or utilizing this literature. You have diatribes against this material, and especially people who dare to use it. Thirdly, the fathers, while they feared it, realized that obviously there were areas in the classical tradition that they could not justifiably avoid. And this, of course, is why this original fear ultimately does not rule the day. One cannot simply throw out everything that the classical writers wrote on astronomy, on music, on the principles of rhetoric or of logic, grammar itself, simply because the goals of the classical tradition, the examples and so forth, elements that were associated with these things, were unacceptable. You simply had to use them. If a man is going to learn to write a proper sentence, there is only one way he can do that, by studying Latin grammar. If he wants to be able to make a good argument, there's only one way he can do that, and that is by studying pagan logic. The church found it necessary. I always think here of St. Ambrose, who's a very good example of this, a man who tried to utilize all that he could out of the classical tradition. What happens then is that the fathers suggest that there are certain areas in the classical tradition where the Christian may feel free to utilize the material. And of course, the two of the obvious areas are those I have already mentioned, grammar and logic. Here they should learn this just as any classical student learned it. But the objective of this learning of the classical tradition should be, as many of them point out, in order to better understand the Holy Scripture. This is why we take certain things from the classical tradition. We take them in order to utilize them in the study of Holy Scripture. See if I can find an example of that here. I think we'll just leave it at that and move along then. The final point that I want to make here is rather unimportant in connection with this. The fourth point would be that they rationalized this. the aspects that you could use and those that you could not use. And I think that some of these rationalizations, I call them that, and that's what I mean, that they were that. I don't think they really, none of these explanations really justify the merely rationalized, but they are interesting for that very reason. One of the most famous of all of the rationalizations was that in Augustine's On Christian Doctrine, where he compares the Christian use of the classics with the Israelites despoiling the Egyptians of their pots and pans. Just as they could use this, as they took this pagan equipment. So we take pagan equipment, but in order to put it to divine uses. Jerome, in his letter to Rufinus, the 21st letter, suggests, just as in the book of Deuteronomy, God ordains that before marriage with a captive, her head and eyebrows must be shaved and her nails cut in order to render her worthy of the bed of her husband, so likewise the Christian who has been seduced by the beauty of secular wisdom must make a beginning by cleansing it, not by throwing it out, but by cleansing it of all that holds of death and idolatry and voluptuousness, error, passion. When thus purified, suitably prepared, it will become worthy to the service of God. Gregory, in typical Gregorian fashion, gets this out of 1 Samuel 13:20. But all the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen every man his share and his axe. The Philistines are secular studies. Secular books are the plain. He says then, one goes to the Philistines then, the secular studies, to sharpen his plow, because secular learning is needed as a training for Christian preaching. You see how the objective now changes. But they do use it in this manner. This is the way they feel they can use it. That takes us down then to D. In this way, they were able to combine the objectives, the educational objectives of the Christian faith with the classical tradition. The next element that comes in E, D isn't too clear here, actually. It's actually a transitional period, that's what I'm trying to say there, in as few words as possible. With Jerome now, you have one of the last of the men who is classically trained, you see. And from then on, the training of the individual who is to exercise teaching authority in the church Even the catechumen becomes monastic training in the early Middle Ages. That's where the schools were, rather than as they had been in the ancient period of the life of the church, the school of the pagan schools of grammar and rhetoric. This is more and more true, and we see Jerome is a very good example of this movement out of one into the other. There are two examples, however, of a non-monastic kind of Christianity that I would like to at least mention here. The first is Ausonius, who was from Aquitaine. You remember that Aquitaine is over here in France, in modern France, southwestern France. It was one of the parts of Gaul at this time that was most Roman, and Ausonius is a very good example of a non-monastic kind of classically trained Christian. But an even better example, and mainly because he comes from the 6th century rather than from the 4th, is Boethius. you have the spelling there on the board. Dies in 524. This is immediately before Justinian comes west to recapture, to take Italy away from the Ostrogoths. Boethius was part of the court of Theodoric, the Ostrogoth, along with Cassiodorus and many other learned individuals. His friendship, the instruction that he gave in the court of Theodoric and the other political offices that he held, have nothing to do with a monastic tradition. This is an individual who represents a synthesis of the classical and the Christian traditions of education that is as yet non-monastic. It's way out of time. By the 6th century, of course, the balance is altogether in the direction of a monastic training. He's late, but he's still one of the better examples that you can find from this period, since we have so much from his pen. He is the individual who has a profound influence on the whole Middle Ages. This is why we have so many of his writings. No philosopher, we are told, was so bone of the bone and flesh of the Middle Ages as was Boethius. His writings were translated into English by Alfred, used by Chaucer, by Dante. They were translated. He wrote in Latin, and they were consequently used in Gaul, in the court of Charlemagne. Alcuin refers to them again and again. They were used in the graduate schools of Oxford and Paris into the 12th and 13th centuries. He is very much a part of the Middle Ages. Classically trained, non-monastic. That's the first thing. Secondly, what he did was to work primarily on transmitting the materials for the quadrivium. Not grammar, rhetoric, and logic so much, the three, what we normally associate with grammar, but rather the other sequence, the quadrivium, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and music. And what Boethius does here, you see, all of these were those things that a Christian could obviously deal with. There's nothing either pagan or Christian about a book in arithmetic. 2 and 2 makes 4, no matter who does the adding. Unless it's Einstein. What he did here, of course, he translated. That's the simplest way of saying it. But it really isn't translation. It's sort of a paraphrase. It's a redoing for his day. He probably redid the arithmetic of Nicomachus. The name there is unimportant. The geometry of Euclid, the astronomy of Ptolemy, at least that's a good guess, and Aristotle on music. So that bringing these materials over from the Greek into Latin so that they could be used in the Latin West is very important for this reason. So that Boetius becomes a very important figure for the quadrivium in the Middle Ages. Then he proceeded to bring over into Latin the logical writings of Aristotle. These were considered harmless. One did not present the metaphysics. This was not so harmless. But the logic, this could be translated, and it was. And he spent most of his life then, at least the latter part of his life, working on various books from the Organon of Aristotle. I don't know, there's a great deal of debate today yet about how much he actually finished. He began by translating Porphyry's Introduction, his Isagogics, to Aristotle's categories, feeling that this was the best way to introduce Aristotle to the Latin West, and then proceeded to translate various parts of Aristotle's logical corpus. But here again, to note the kind of classical writing that the Christian felt acceptable in a Christian educational system. At the very end of his life, right before he was cast into prison, Boetius writes a work on the Holy Trinity. There has been some journal material on whether or not perhaps Boetius was in prison, not merely for irritating the Theodoric, but mainly for his views on the Holy Trinity. Now, true or not, having listened to one of the debates of the Christian clergy in Italy on the Holy Trinity in the 6th century, Boetius can only quote Horace to the effect that he feared lest he should rightly be set down as insane if he held out for some sanity, philosophical sanity, among these madmen, who, as far as he was concerned, didn't have the foggiest notion of what they were talking about. It may well be that this is why Boetius ultimately ends his life in prison, whether it was true or not. In any case, he does, either for that, or maybe both and, for that and as a result of the fact that he was quite sympathetic to the Catholic Christian, or to the Christian Christianity of the East, of Justinian, rather than to the Arian Christianity of Theodoric. We don't know. But this was a period when Theodoric and the Ostrogoths were losing their power in Italy to the Eastern authority under Justinian. In any case, out of the prison then, as you probably know, comes that great classical piece of prison literature, along with Bunyan and Bonhoeffer, The Consolation of Philosophy. I used to spend a great deal of time on that in this course, but it takes much too much time for what we have in the course as a whole. And anyway, I think this should be part of your liberal arts training, too. If you've never read this, again, I would suggest it. It's in the Modern Library and many other translations. That's one that's quite easily accessible. To sit down and to read this, one of the earliest pieces of Christian philosophy. After you're finished, I'm sure you will perhaps feel the way I felt, that there's very little in this that one can really call specifically Christian. But at least it's an attempt at Christian philosophy. Now, if you will, to compare the efforts of Boetius in this regard which are much more classical in their orientation. Boethius assumes the whole classical metaphysics, even though he is a confessed Christian. He is concerned, and indeed his concern shapes the philosophy of the Middle Ages, with the whole question of universals. You see, these are the things about which he is concerned, with the concerns of Jerome, you see. Monastic in his orientation, and all of his scholarly efforts in the area of translating, transmitting, commenting specifically upon biblical material, you see. And we'll take that up then in contrast next time.